From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, medium James Van Praagh joins us with some incredible stories, but here's what's happening. Ariel Castro, now he was the one who was sentenced to life plus 1,000 years for kidnapping, raping, and holding captive 3 women. He was found hanging in his prison cell Tuesday night in Ohio. Officials found Castro, 52 years old, hanging in his cell at the Correctional Reception Center in Ohio. Prison medical staff tried to revive him. They could not. He was housed in protective custody, which means he was in a cell by himself, and rounds are required every 30 minutes at staggered intervals. It's during one of those intervals they found him hanging to death. The leaders of both parties in the House of Representatives emerging from a White House meeting to support President Barack Obama's call for American strikes against government forces in Syria's civil war. Mr. Obama met with congressional leaders to lobby for their support on Syria, promising that American strikes would deliver important results while keeping the United States out of a larger war. Robert Young Pelton, of course, author, journalist, let's check in with him. Well, Robert, it looks like we're going to go in some form or fashion, doesn't it?
Yeah, it looks like he's got support of both sides of the House. And unfortunately, the Thursday, the 5th, would be the best day. That's when the new moon is out and you can't see aircraft in the sky. But it looks like he's not going to do it until sometimes, and I think he's got 60 days to launch strikes. But unfortunately, that's not the end game. I mean, we can't win or deter Assad by simply firing in cruise missiles or air-launched missiles. We have to put some people on the ground. So there's a group of proxy rebels waiting to go in that are going to then try to secure those chemical weapon sites.
Robert, my concern, too, is the reaction of the Russians and the Chinese who've been saying, don't do this. What's going to happen?
Well, it's actually also the North Koreans and the Iranians, because these are part of the rogue nations that we've always been talking about. So if we're back in the regime change business, Russia, North Korea, Iran's not that far behind. So it's in their best interest to push back as hard as they can.
All right. We will watch these days unfold. Robert Young Pelton, of course. The Stubborn Rim Fire, one of the largest wildfires in California's history, it's now 70% contained. With rain and cooler temperatures in the forecast, the firefighters who have fought for days will likely make further gains in the coming days, except they don't expect a full containment until September 20th. What a disaster out there. Japan is going to invest hundreds of millions of dollars, $473 million to be exact, into building a frozen wall around the Fukushima plant to stop leaks of radioactive water. The leaks were getting worse, and the government felt it was essential to become involved the greatest extent possible to try to contain that. We've been reporting on this for some time now. There could be at least 320,000 viruses awaiting discovery that are circulating in animals, according to a study. Researchers say that identifying these viral diseases, especially those that can spread to us, could help to prevent future pandemics. Story we've talked about, of course, are we all Martians? A controversial hypothesis contends that life on our planet had to get its start somewhere else, most likely on Mars, because the chemistry on early Earth couldn't have provided the required molecular machinery. That's the theory, of course, of Stephen Benner, a chemist at the Florida-based Foundation for Applied Molecular Evolution. And let's check in with Stephen now. Stephen, great theory. Tell me a little bit more how you came to this conclusion.
Well, good morning. Let's see where we start. The most important thing, I think, is to understand that the question, you know, how life originated is one of these things that cannot be approached using the scientific method that we're taught in middle school, you know, unbiased observation followed by hypothesis, followed by, deft experiments that lead to a blue ribbon in a science fair. What has happened over the past 5 years is that chemists, and myself included, have started by asking what kinds of complex biological molecules are necessary to get life started. One of those, of course, is a genetic molecule like DNA, but in our case, the most popular molecule, genetic molecule that has been proposed to get life started is RNA, ribonucleic acid, which is a close relative of DNA. It's a pretty complicated molecule, and so people, including ourselves, have been trying to find in the laboratory conditions where organic molecules, you know, that would have been present on early Earth, Mars, and in fact are present on Titan and other places throughout the solar system, might give RNA, or at least its precursors, without the aid of a biological system. Well, the first problem that you have to solve when you're doing this is to try to prevent the organic molecules from devolving to give tar. This is a very common observation. Perhaps you've made it yourself when you've left the stove on too long in the kitchen, right? You give organic stuff too much heat for too long, and it turns gooey, tarry, and eventually becomes asphalt. You know, more suited for paving roads than starting life. One of the things that we have shown is that certain minerals, especially minerals like borax, like you find in Death Valley, it contains an element boron, which is in the form of a borate salt, captures organic material and prevents it from devolving to give tar. And so that's a good step in the right direction, especially since borax is very effective and borate minerals in general are very effective with carbohydrates. The second thing that we've shown, again, in the laboratory is that if you have another mineral, one here that contains the element molybdenum, that's hard to say at this hour of the morning, but in the form of the unoxidized form called molybdate, it will take some of the carbohydrates that the borate has captured and rearranged and give ribose, which is the R in RNA, and that's kind of good. And, you know, there's all sorts of other things that one needs. For example, every now and then you need to dry the sample out. For that, we actually do look for a dry land surface or desert environment.
Well, these building blocks, Stephen, let me ask you, how do we know it, they came from Mars as opposed to an asteroid or a meteorite from, you know, outside the solar system?
No, absolutely. That's a good question. And so they could have actually come from Earth. The difficulty is that when you have all of what I just described to you, this is, you know, being done in a laboratory with safety glasses and a lab coat and beakers.
Yeah.
At some point, right, you got to say, wait a minute, 4 billion years ago when life started, there weren't any beakers. This is not, well, certainly no safety glasses or lab coats. What was going on here was going on the surface of a planet. And then our geological friends come in. They say, well, Stephen, this is great chemistry, but, you know, on early Earth, the amount of water on early Earth was very large, and pretty much all of the Earth was submerged because the continents were not yet formed. So you can't have dry land on early Earth. It's the water world, like, you know, Kevin Costner. And, you know, you can't have, if you have a water world, you cannot concentrate borax to help you keep organic material from devolving to tar. And oh, by the way, molybdate, you can't have that either because early Earth was not very oxidizing. There was no oxygen in the air back then. And so, you know, the next thing you know is the chemists, of course, are all disappointed and in despair. We, you know, our knuckles dragging the room. We leave the floor. We leave the room. And then the geologists say, well, but wait. All the conditions that you want are available on Mars. So, you know, Mars has never had the amount of water, liquid water, that Earth had. It has had much more water than it has now. But, hey, if you want dry land, with intermittent water, there's always there on Mars. By the way, and not on asteroids. Borax, you go, can be concentrated on Mars. In fact, Steve Freelander a couple weeks ago from the University of Hawaii just published a paper showing their discovery of, they had a sample of Mars, and they found borax or borate minerals in it. There's another paper that's just impressed now from the University of Nevada in Las Vegas showing that phosphates are easily eluted from minerals on Mars much more easily than Earth. Phosphorus is, of course, a very important part of DNA and RNA as well. So the geologists, after taking away their hope for any of the environments that we wanted for chemistry on Earth, have pointed to Mars as a place where these all take place. In fact, the conditions might even be suitable for the formation of some of the components of RNA even now.
Well, I got to tell you, Stephen, that's exciting and well worthy of some more time with you at a later date. Absolutely riveting. So life probably started on Earth because of Mars. And that's an amazing story all by itself. Hey, it's called The End of Money. Counterfeiters, preachers, techies, dreamers, and the coming cashless society. Reach into your pocket right now. Any cash might not be around much longer. David Woolman joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. The End of Money. David Woolman is a contributing editor at Wired. He has also written for such publications as the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Nature, Outside, Forbes, Discover, Salon, and a finalist for the 2012 National Magazine Award for Reporting. In his new book, which is just out in paperback now, The End of Money, we will talk about this and some of the things that David has gone through, for example, over the last year, trying to go without using cash. David, welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
I'm well, George. How about yourself?
Good, good. Cashless society. I've always thought it was going to happen, maybe sooner than later. Tell me about your attempt to go without cash for a year and how that test worked for you.
Sure. Well, one of the goals of that personal experiment, if you will, was to make sure that this was not going to be an academic sort of white paper. If I wanted to explore the history and future, or perhaps dubious future, of physical money, it seems like a smart idea to say, well, okay, this cashless future thing, could I glimpse it by trying to live it? And by eschewing cash and not even touching this stuff, you know, what sort of hang-ups or hiccups might I run into in my everyday life? And, you know, more broadly than just one guy's experience, what larger issues might that personal experience illuminate? In other words, tipping, for example, you know, if going without cash means that I'm cheating people out of a well-earned tip, you know, down the line, that is sort of an important point in favor of defending cash, let's say. So this was a way for me to kind of keep this as an ongoing meditation in my everyday life. And then also a way to kind of, again, keep that conversational tone going, as if you and I were talking about the role of physical money in the economy and in our lives over a beer, as opposed to in a PhD program. So when I was trying to live without cash for the year, you know, I am a sample size of just one. So that immediately is something of a problem. And I don't work in the service sector as an author and journalist. I'm doing a lot of typing or sitting in a cafe or traveling by a means by which I can use plastic or some other form of non-physical money payment. So many weeks would go by, actually, when I wasn't, I wouldn't really notice that I was cashless. And then all of a sudden, I'd get hit with something of a pickle, or I would run into a pickle. There was a time when I had to pay the babysitter. My wife didn't have any cash on her, and I tried unsuccessfully to convince the babysitter's father to open a PayPal account on the fly, but he was not so hot. He was not so hot on that idea. So I figured, you know, this is not really a cutthroat sort of study I'm conducting here. I think it's fair to actually hit pause on the experiment and pay the babysitter her well-earned income for dealing with my young critters. And then, you know, things take a more serious turn when I actually flew to India to report out a section of the book that maybe we'll talk about later. And the reality is that although mobile technologies are rapidly impacting the way we use money and the different forms of money we use in different circumstances, we are not there yet. In other words, the cashless future is not here tomorrow or even 4 years from now. And if you want to do anything outside of your hotel room in India or a place like India, you're still going to need a heap of banknotes, those, you know, sticky, soiled, humid, germ-saturated things. you're going to need them in your pocket if you want to hire a taxi or get some bottled water or visit some historic site to pay my translator if he wanted to be paid with cash. So, you know, we're certainly not there yet, and I'm not a rich enough author that I could, you know, sort of do a mulligan with the trip to India and get it okay from my wife.
Well, you know, I was once again. David, I was thinking, you know, right before you came on, how have I used cash or what do I use it for? And I was going through a list of things, a litany of things. My gasoline, I pay with a credit card at the pump. When I go to the grocery store or any store, I use a credit card. When I'm writing, you know, like bills or mortgages, it's all checks from money that's, you know, electronically in my account. So I don't see the cash. So really all I've been using cash for that I can recall might be tips, you know, when you valet your car in LA or wherever you go and things, smaller things like that. But not a lot of money. We probably are close to 85% cashless right now, aren't we?
More so. And, you know, this is a helpful starting point for our conversation. I'm glad you bring it up because so many people are frightened by the sort of banner phrases like the digital money future. And the reality is, like it or not, we are already in the soup with electronic money. In other words, most money today is already zeros and ones on distant servers. You know, the vast majority of money, there's something like $1 trillion in U.S. paper money floating around, quote-unquote, in circulation, most of which, of course, is stuffed in steel briefcases or under mattresses owned by Mexican drug kingpins. But whatever, in circulation, money floating out there. And, you know, there's trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars that exist and that we, in terms of value. And, of course, we know that all of a sudden that can go poof, as it did a few years ago at the apex of the financial crisis. People were saying, well, where does all that money go when the Lehman Brothers collapses? And the answer is, it just goes poof. and it, that, interestingly, something as stark as the financial crisis has the same effect on someone like me as contemplating physical notes and coins, because there is this interesting question of whether we'll be cashless, but to me, it actually points to some much larger and more interesting questions, which is what, you know, what is money in the first place? What gives it value in the first place? Gotcha. And of course, right now with coin of the realm, the answer to that is faith and trust in the issuing institution. And the dollar is only a dollar because you and I believe it has value. There's really all kinds of religious language that has to be employed when talking about currency, or at least physical currency, you know, not so much for a barrel of wheat, but that's sort of the world that we live in now. So circling back to your question a little bit, you know, most money is already electronic. So the question is, okay, well, cash has dug in its heels in certain corners of the economy. And let's wander over to those corners or to that edge of the cliff and see why cash has stuck around for as long as it has. It's a magnificent technology. And yet, let's also put it in the hot seat a little bit and be a little more honest about its costs and some of the pluses and minuses of other forms of money and have this conversation about whether we should keep the stuff around or whether we should finally elbow it off the edge of the cliff.
Well, you know, do you ever see the day, for example, David, where a drug deal will come down with a credit card and the drug dealer will have his little swiping machine?
You know, probably. I'm sure some, you know, crooks are entrepreneurs and innovators too, right? So a lot of people say to me, one of the arguments in favor of getting rid of cash, or at least high denomination notes like the 100, is that this is the blood that flows in the veins of crime, right? And so you would make life a lot harder for underworld operatives if you got rid of cash.
That's right.
Likewise, you know, while I was writing the book, there are 10,000 bank robberies in the United States, but the thugs don't really get that much. But you and I also have to pay for FBI to chase them all down. We have to pay for PTSD therapy for bank employees. We have to pay for new security at the banks. We have to prosecute and incarcerate all of these clowns. And you know, point being, will crime go away when we get rid of cash? Of course not. You know, just ask a Bernie Madoff victim.
Right.
But will business be a little bit harder for many, many different varieties of criminals out there? Absolutely. And, you know, I do think that a lot of criminal enterprise, of course, right now exists in cyberspace and they are using credit cards. You know, you mentioned that you use a card to buy gas or buy your groceries and things like that. And you know, that's an interesting point because you're someone who clearly knows that maybe these are not the most ethically wonderful companies out there. And you certainly are someone who knows that there's all kinds of fraud when it comes to credit card usage. And yet, the thing that happened to you in your life somewhere is that you, unfortunately, or fortunately, you saw a value proposition. And you said, you know what, it actually just makes more sense for me to accept those risks and use these tools. They're as imperfect as they may be, holding my wealth in the form of physical money.
It's easy, David. Foolish. Hey, David, hold on for a second. We're going to hit the break and come back, talk more about this incredible story, The End of Money. Well, David Woolman mentions the Antichrist in his work, The End of Money, so we'll talk with him about that as well here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie over at the coasttocoastam.com website under our highlight reel. We've got a story about the big problem with the new $100 bills, and David Woolman, of course, wrote a piece for The New Yorker on the problem with these bills that's supposed to come out this fall. Apparently, they're using too much ink, David. What happened here?
Yeah, well, this is yet more egg in still more faces over at the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. We were supposed to see the new $100 bill a couple of years ago, and they ran into a production problem there that had to do with a crease. And a little bit like when you have a small fold in your shirt and you run the iron over it, and now you have a sharp crease. Well, yeah, that happened with the bills, and on the underside, then they were white because there was no ink applied to that underside of the crease. Okay, so that was like a huge snafu, cost tons of money. They had to stop production everywhere and figure out what on earth was going wrong. They got it all sorted out, and then more recently, I learned through a source that they ran into another problem. This one, the term of art is called mashing. And it's a little bit like if your 5-year-old is trying desperately to color inside the lines with a really fat marker or a paintbrush. And so you're going to get bleeding over the lines where you would like to see very crisp artwork. So this meant that another, I think it was like $30 billion worth in face value of notes had to be returned essentially from the Federal Reserve to the Bureau. And they halted production at the Washington, D.C. facility, but luckily the much smaller Texas facility that makes the money, so to speak, will just kick into high gear. And allegedly, they will still make their own self-assigned October 8th deadline to deliver the wonderful new $100 bill out into circulation and to you and me and drug dealers and mafioso and tax evaders everywhere.
I love it. I love it. Now, the money, of course, is fiat, which means there's nothing really backing it anymore. The Federal Reserve prints it up. Of course, they're a consortium of private banks. I mean, who gives them, David, the right to print up as much money as they want? I mean, is the government saying do this, or are they just doing this on their own?
Well, it's, you know, they sort of do it on their own, but it's this relationship between, you know, I hate that it sounds so wonky, but fiscal policy of government and monetary policy of a central bank. And they, you know, they're inevitably intertwined. And this decision to increase the money supply is what you're talking about. And, you know, let's not kid ourselves. The decisions that the Federal Reserve has made and this phenomenon of increasing the money supply as opposed to using something so terribly rigid as gold dug up out of the ground somewhere, you know, this has been an incredible generator of prosperity for a century or so. It's you know, a terribly imperfect system as it is. I just don't want to sound like an instant conspiracy theorist. My role is to wonder aloud a little bit more about where it all comes from, because that part of it is really magical and peculiar and frightening.
It's bizarre.
The entire financial system rests on the head of a pin that is built out of trust that you will accept this piece of paper from me, or a digital representation of this piece of otherwise useless paper as payment for goods and services. And you put faith in it because you're fairly confident that your grocer or barber or a life insurance provider will also accept it. And it's kind of around and around we go. And that's horrifying to a lot of people for obvious reasons, but
sure,
you know, there is a magic to it as far as the level of trust we do have in all of each other, and the fact that you can go buy a hamburger with this stuff tomorrow and don't have to go to war to acquire a burger.
This is something else. Now, are the Russians and the Chinese printing up worthless money as well and using it, or is it just us?
Oh, every country does this. I mean, this is national currencies. This is central banking. Now, actually not every country does this, because if you're part of the Eurozone, you don't have the power to make your national currency. Now you have sort of at the mercy of the European Central Bank, which
or a poor third world country, you're stuck, right?
Yeah, you're sort of stuck, but you know they make their own money too. But this idea of the value incarnate, right? So what makes a dollar, that sounds very ethereal and weird. But the reality is you're probably going to denominate your kid's college fund in U.S. dollars or maybe parentheses, euros or Swiss francs or something like that. You're not going to denominate your kid's college fund in Somali shilling, which derives their value from the very same phenomenon, right? The user's faith in it. And you and I are just not that trusting of the Somali government or the issuing institution of the central bank. So we say, okay, as imperfect as the greenback is, it seems like a safer bet than Somali shillings. So this is kind of the game we're playing with national currencies. And it's also why we're seeing so much enthusiasm in the world of alternative currencies, especially this thing called Bitcoin, because so many people express the trepidation that you're touching on right now. And so they say, well, wait a minute, I don't trust these government clowns and I don't trust these bankers. I want to trust mathematics. I want to trust algorithms. I want to trust the digital groupthink. And so I want to trust in a currency like Bitcoin. And, you know, this isn't a vote for or against it. It's fascinating to see all of this excitement about all of these alternative currencies, largely, I think, catalyzed by the recent financial crisis.
David, you talk about the Antichrist, the mark of the beast, people having microchips. You talk about everything we talk about on this program in the end of money. Welcome to the club.
Well, you know, this was important to me that, again, you know, touching back on this idea that I was frightened, frankly, of writing something that would be bland and academic, and I wanted to get out there and make this kind of a travelogue search for answers to these questions of what gives money value in the first place, and where does physical money come from, and what would it mean to get rid of cash completely? And, of course, one subset of the population that really does not like the idea of completely euthanizing money in physical form are people who apply a literal interpretation to the book of Revelation, and they think that once we have no more physical money, you're basically handing the keys to the kingdom over to the Antichrist. And that is because part of this particular section of the book of Revelation says that the devil will have absolute control over the economy from his or her secret lair somewhere. And so if you are eliminating cash, you are basically enabling that entirely centralized control of commerce. And, you know, some people buy that, some people don't. But what's important to me is actually that even if you don't subscribe to that kind of viewpoint, it is actually only a magnified or exaggerated version of a much more common anxiety, which is about privacy, period. In other words, transacting with cash keeps me and my life and my transactions in the dark, so that government and marketers and bankers and credit card companies can't necessarily know what I'm doing. And, you know, goodness knows we should be standing up for and fighting for increased privacy in the modern age, but the conversation shouldn't stop there. You know, that's an important point in defense of cash, that it provides anonymity. But as I try to articulate in the book, you know, that is one of many, many points, both on the plus and minus side, for when it comes to dealing in cash. Because on the flip side, if you want to be able to sniff out money laundering or aspiring terrorists or other kinds of crime, many people say it is appropriate for law enforcement to have a kind of break the glass access to financial transaction records so that they can do business. I'm not saying it should be one way or the other, but I think a simplified view of this stuff really belies reality.
Well, you know, nowadays, if you go and get a bank loan, everything is, you know, under the microscope, David, of Homeland Security, just about everything, from your ID to, you know, the purpose of the funds and everything else. Did this all happen because of 9/11?
No, I think some of it happened earlier. A lot of anti-money laundering legislation, for example, is important for that stuff. Bankers use this annoying turn of phrase called Know Your Customer Regulations, KYC. They always throw around at these conferences I'm sometimes attending now, telling them how the rest of us think about money. And, yeah. You know, so I think 9/11, of course, it amplified all of that, and it just accelerated that the scrutiny trend or the privacy invasion trend, and with Homeland Security and with prison and all of this. But, you know, the reality is if you're a banker, you do want to know a little bit about who you're loaning to. So, you know, where do you draw the line is sort of the tricky question. And, I'm certainly not a shill for bankers or credit card companies, but I sympathize. I wouldn't want to just loan money to anyone. And, you know, there's a big part of the book that talks about how no-frills, very boring secure deposits banking is actually quite a public service. And you and I don't really stop to think about that too much because it's easy and important to be slamming bankers and to be angry with bankers for all of their extracurriculars, especially in recent years. However, I know that you were just talking about your own use of a credit card, and you probably have a bank account. So unless you're hiding your wealth in the form of gold bullion under your bed, you say yes to the digital money proposition or the electronic money proposition. You say yes to the formal economy and banks. And that doesn't mean you like collateralized debt obligations and all this other mischief that got us in so much trouble a few years ago. That's investment banker silliness. But just no frills, secure and safe way to store your money and protect your wealth. You know, it's not perfect, but it's something that we do in this day and age. And that's something that helps people build financial stability, which at the end of the day, that is what everybody wants. They want stability for themselves and their children and their grandchildren. So the question is, okay, well, what forms of money in what circumstances help us achieve that stability?
I've got to tell you, and this took me a while, but I like it now, and that is direct deposit. When our company, for example, first started this, it was, direct deposit as opposed to getting a payroll check. And, I've always been used, I'm from old school, David. So I'm always used to, you put in your 2 weeks good work, you get your check, and, you go to your bank, you put it in, and so be it. Well, then all of a sudden direct deposit came along, and I don't have to worry about rushing to the bank. It's there. I mean, when payday comes, you go online, you look at your bank account, it's there. And I got to tell you, I kind of like that now. I never thought I would. But, I mean, I've been sold on direct deposit. I wonder how many people have been.
Well, I love the turn of phrase. It's there. Many people would say it's not there. It's just a promise, a binary promise from a bank to you that there's this value. And yet it works. So, relatively well. It reminds me of a story I recently heard. A banker was saying that years ago they had a robbery and, no one was hurt. It was a pretty run-of-the-mill event. But nevertheless, there's police tape across the door, and an elderly woman came by the bank, and she knocked on the window, and he came to the door and greeted her, and she said, "What happened?" He said, "We had a robbery. Everything's fine. We'll be open late this afternoon or tomorrow," or something like that. And she said, "Well, did they get my money?" And, that is how a lot of people think about money and value in the modern age. They don't it's uncomfortable to think that most money is electronic or that most money is just a promise from a bank to you and that they don't have it all there. They don't even have nearly all of it there. But, as you said, with direct deposit, you were anxious or thought that was too dangerous or too weird or too mysterious years ago. But you grew to see the value proposition and you became accustomed to it. And lo and behold, the world did not come screeching to a halt. And, this is our legacy as human beings. New technologies frighten us. Long ago, people thought if you put a radio in an automobile, there will be carnage all over the highways. And then they did it and people started to listen to it. And slowly they realized that the world did not come to an end. And they sort of liked listening to your show or other things on the radio while driving. And so they started to use it. And the same thing with credit cards and the same thing with direct deposit that you're talking about. A new one now, for example, would be taking a picture of a check with your mobile phone and then
depositing it that way.
And then it deposits it that way. Yeah. So now all of those people out there who are wasting so many hours out of their year traveling to and from the bank to deposit a very modest checks in physical form, they can skip that. And they can get back to the business of taking care of their kids or going to a soccer game or looking for a job, all kinds of things. You know, these are huge money savers. And again, people think at first, oh, that's too dangerous. It's scary. I don't get it. Where's my money? But as soon as you see the value proposition, you know, boom, surprise, surprise, people say yes.
You can even drop cash into an ATM now and the machine will count it out and put it right into your account. It does sound like it probably is. One day it's going to keep. Here's the downside on all this, David. One day, mark my word, we're going to get hit by an X flare from the sun that's going to be big enough to disrupt electronics and communications and our power grid. And then all of us who have lived with, gotten used to ATMs, electronic banking, and all this stuff, we're going to be up a creek because something is going to go awry here, and it's going to be a disaster. I can feel it.
Well, it's in fact, you know, it's one of the strongest defenses for keeping some physical cash in circulation, at least in the near to midterm, is that long-term power outage problem. But you know, I think to me, frankly, the conversation isn't as interesting when we're too focused on whether cash goes the way of the dinosaurs or not, you know, whether or not it goes extinct, even though, you know, that's part of promoting the book and all that, the end of money, blah, blah, blah. But to me, it's actually these forces that are further marginalizing cash and the effects that that's having on the economy and on people's lives and on as a very positive development for international development and fighting poverty, for example. Those forces or the enthusiasm about something like Bitcoin that we were talking about before, these trends are far more interesting than whether cash will ever really be kaput. I do see us pushing it further toward the periphery. I do think that we should get rid of pennies and nickels and dimes yesterday. Likewise for the $100 bill, the 500 euro note, you know, in Spain, they call this thing the bin Laden because everybody knows what they look like, but no one's ever seen one. You know, what are these things used for? They're not used for what cash should be used for, which is to promote commerce and grease trade. You know, they're just used for criminal activity. So, you know, that's why here in the U.S. we got rid of the $500 and $1,000 bill back in 1969. So a lot of people are saying, let's just demonetize the $100 bill. Give people a couple of years to turn them in for 50s and 20s, and it brings all of this criminal activity into the sunlight. And so I think that kind of thing is good. But in the middle range, 5, 10s, 20s, you know, if you're going to be putting people out, of course you don't get rid of cash. Or if, like you said, you know, you're really worried about a solar flare or a power outage that isn't just 8 days but 8 weeks or months, you know, these are strong reasons to keep cash around at least in the near term.
Absolutely. I remember when I was a kid during Halloween and growing up in the Detroit area, our neighbor across the street, instead of giving us candy, would always give us 2 pennies. And, you know, this is back in the 60s. And, gosh, I hated pennies, David, you know, ever since then. I mean, you'd go up to his door, you do your trick-or-treating, and Mr. Kozar would come to he's dead now, so I can use his name. He would he'd come to the door and he'd have a handful of pennies and he'd drop 2 of them in your bag. And, you know, we'd go home and we'd dump out the candy and we'd sort through it. And in those days, you know, mom would go through the candy to make sure some wacko wasn't putting pins and needles in these things. And there would be the 2 cents. And, you know, we kept it. And I guess 2 cents bought some things in those days, but you know what? It just wasn't like the candy. I never liked pennies after that. You're right. It's almost a useless coin, isn't it?
Oh, it's totally useless. And actually, this is what got me started on this whole quest initially. You know, this whole project started so tiny, really. You know, I ran into a small news item about the cost of manufacturing pennies and nickels. And at the time, you know, things move a little bit depending on the price of the metal ingredients. But at the time, it was like 2.5 cents. Per unit, per penny, to make the thing. And 9 or 10 cents per unit per nickel. You know, this is on you, the taxpayer.
Yeah.
You are funding this
bad business
of producing totally, valueless coins at a loss because they don't buy anything. And economists would tell you, you'd be crazy to bend down and pick a penny up off the street.
But I do. I got to admit, if I see a penny, I pick it up just because
I
don't want to corner.
Rational economic.
Hey, David, we're going to take some phone calls with you when we come back. Also, a question, of course, will be direct deposit or checks. What do you prefer? And then questions with David Woolman as we talk about his work, The End of Money. I'm George Norrie. Split show tonight. Final hour with David on Coast to Coast AM.